I next met with Dr. Greg Riley, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This guy's a 48-year-old guy, works in the financial industry, and he developed a little bit of shortness of breath as his initial presentation. X-ray showed a pleural effusion, and CT scan confirmed the pleural effusion, as well as a lung mass. The lung mass was relatively small. We drained the pleural effusion, and all that was left really was that lung mass.
Non-smoker?
He was a never smoker. That's absolutely right. Never smoker, no other family risk factors or anything like that. So when we drained the effusion, we also did a pleural biopsy, and the material from that came back, and we did our multiplex testing on that. We looked for ALK, EGFR, KRAS, and then the long list of about 300 other genes that we care about in non-small cell lung cancer. And the tumor came back with an ALK gene rearrangement. And, you know, we sat down and talked about it, and he liked the idea of an oral therapy, and we started with crizotinib monotherapy. And he did really well with that. At the time, he had become asymptomatic because the pleural effusion had drained. So we couldn't follow him symptomatically, but by following CT scans, he did very well with a great shrinkage of tumor.
Just out of curiosity, did he have the visual changes associated with crizotinib?
You know, he did have a little bit, but it's interesting. I had to prompt him to talk about it. And a lot of these patients, I always tell them about that when I sit down to prescribe the medicine. I tell them, you know, one important side effect you should hear about is visual side effects, and I tell them what I've heard other patients describe. And then when I went back to see him after a couple months on therapy, I said, so, any side effects? And he said, none whatsoever. I said, how about those eye side effects? Well, yeah, sure, they happen sometimes, but it doesn't bother me.
When you say you relate what you've heard from patients, what have you heard from patients?
Probably the most common thing I hear people describe is strings in peripheral vision. And in particular, they notice this when they turn on the bathroom light in the morning. If you go from a dark room, flip on the light, and then you see these sort of strings in peripheral vision, they disappear after a few seconds.
Does he have an objective response?
Yeah, so radiographically has a PR. And I follow him with CAT scans every 3 months. That's sort of my routine. I also follow liver function tests during that course, too, to make sure that the crizotinib doesn't affect liver function tests too much. And, you know, the issue of brain metastases is a big one in patients with ALK-positive lung cancer treated with crizotinib. And as a consequence, I routinely do surveillance brain MRI. This is something I have to admit I never do for patients with ALK-negative disease. I occasionally do it for patients with EGFR mutant disease. But for the most part, I'm not doing surveillance MRIs for my patients. But for patients with ALK-positive lung cancer on crizotinib, I do surveillance MRIs because I feel like this is a common site of metastatic disease, a common site of resistance, and I want to catch it before it becomes symptomatic.
When you say it's a common site of resistance, is this sort of a blood-brain barrier thing or what?
You know, I hesitate to say that it's a blood-brain barrier thing, but it probably is a blood-brain barrier thing. And when I say that, I mean that crizotinib doesn't get to high enough concentrations in the brain to adequately prevent progression of disease. We certainly see patients respond to crizotinib, and so there was a recent paper in the JCO that demonstrated patients with ALK-positive lung cancer do get a response to crizotinib in their brain metastases. But although they respond, the duration of response may be shorter in the brain than it is systemically, and it's a common site of relapse or progression.
I think I saw that there was a trial, but I think it might have been an EGFR-positive disease of prophylactic cranial radiation. Is that a strategy that's being considered or looked at in any of these targetable situations?
It is certainly considered oftentimes, and I think it's a reasonable thing to think about, though I have to admit that the effects of prophylactic cranial radiation are significant. And if you can identify these brain metastases before they become symptomatic and deploy the radiation at that point, I think it may be more effective and reduce the burden on patients.
Well, ideally, the patient wouldn't need radiation because we could cure or completely control the disease, and maybe that's going to be feasible. Anyhow, in terms of this case, I see that you did a surveillance brain MRI and unfortunately showed disease.
That's right. One of the reasons I do the surveillance MRIs is because I want to find when I see one spot or two spots. And then you can send those patients for a stereotactic radiosurgery kind of treatment to the brain, you know, focused radiation, and avoid the side effects of whole brain and extract more time with crizotinib therapy and therefore prevent, you know, having to jump to the next drug. But unfortunately for him, we didn't find one or two spots. We found hundreds, you know, in this sort of miliary pattern, which we've probably all seen in patients with lung cancer, where they have, you know, these just tiny, tiny spots throughout the brain. These aren't really amenable to stereotactic radiotherapy. And I think that we will oftentimes treat those patients with whole brain radiation therapy. And I think that is a very reasonable approach. But for this patient, he was really averse to the notion of getting whole brain radiation therapy. He was continuing to work actively and he didn't want the hair loss problem to affect his work relationships. And as a consequence, we made a switch to a different ALK inhibitor, and that's the drug ceritinib that was approved last year for the treatment of ALK-positive lung cancer, previously treated with crizotinib.
So before we get into that, just to sort of backtrack, so he has this miliary disease that you pick up at 12 months on crizotinib. What about the systemic disease, the other sites of disease?
Systemic disease is perfectly controlled.
And so he goes on ceritinib, and what happened?
He gets a great response, and essentially the follow-up brain MRI done a month later, and then another one done 3 months later, showed complete resolution of the disease in the brain.
And what's his current situation? Is he still on ceritinib?
Yeah, he continues on ceritinib and is doing well.
Wow. How long has he been on it?
About 9 months now.
Wow. And what about tolerability? Has he had any problems? I heard about GI problems with ceritinib.
Yeah, I think the GI problems are the biggest challenge in determining the right dose of ceritinib to give. You know, the FDA-approved dose of ceritinib is 750 milligrams, and that's a pretty high dose. The number of patients treated with that dose is relatively low, and our full understanding of the side effects is probably yet to be determined. I think that when I start a patient on ceritinib, I don't routinely start with the full 750 milligrams dosing. I will often start at 600 milligrams daily. You know, these come as 150 milligram tablets. So for the patient getting full dose, they're getting five tablets. So I'll often start with four tablets as my initial treatment for the young, fit person. Sometimes for older people, I'll even back off to 450 milligrams as my starting dose. Then we work between the two major toxicities, which is GI effects where the patient experiences nausea and or diarrhea. And then the other problem that we see is liver function test abnormalities that are something that we'll have to monitor and adjust dose based upon.
What dose did you start this 48-year-old man on?
I started him on 600.
And did you escalate him up or you just kept him on 600?
So he actually required a dose reduction. So after a week at 600, he was quite miserable. And, you know, we tried a variety of other approaches, like, you know, the package insert says to take it on an empty stomach, and most of the initial data is taking it on an empty stomach. We tried taking it with a small amount of food to see if that helped.
He had nausea and vomiting and diarrhea, or just...
That's right. Nausea and vomiting was the dominant thing.
Nausea and vomiting.
There was some diarrhea component as well.
And so you tried to do supportive measures before you dose reduced?
That's right. We tried taking it with food, tried spreading the dose out during the day. You know, this is four tablets. You could take it, you know, four times over the course of the day, a variety of things we tried. And that didn't really get to where we wanted to go. And so we backed down to 450 milligrams and he began to tolerate that a bit better. And he's one of these people who's very finicky about taking medicines and tries to map out when it's going to work out best for him in terms of relationship to meals and that kind of thing. And over time, he's worked out a system where he doesn't have significant nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea, and he's able to take 600 milligrams. But it's taken a lot of tweaking of the system by him.
And so he's currently on 600?
That's right.
You know, when you think about this case, I mean, I'm not a chemist exactly, but certainly the names look pretty similar, crizotinib, ceritinib. I'm guessing there's not that much difference. I mean, do you think what we're seeing here is about brain penetration or something else?
Well, I think that the drugs are very similar, but the main thing is that the effectiveness of binding for ceritinib to ALK is much better than it is for crizotinib. And the off-target effect that we see for crizotinib, which, you know, MET inhibition is often the off-target effect that we see a lot of with crizotinib, we don't see that in ceritinib. But I think that just the simply binding ALK better is the explanation for why it works better in the brain, and it's also the explanation of why it works better systemically. So for those patients who do progress on crizotinib systemically, they respond relatively well to ceritinib, not because it targets some other pathway, but because it just simply hits ALK better.
Yeah, that kind of makes a lot of sense. And I guess that really leads into where are things heading? What's the optimal sequence? You know, I've heard people say, well, in the long run, it's still better to start with crizotinib, although hearing about this case, you think twice about it. What do we know data-wise right now, and what do you think we're going to know in a couple of years?
What we know now is a little bit of data on patients in the early trials who were treated with ceritinib as a first-line agent. I think the idea is drug A plus drug B or drug B from the start, right? And so if in this situation you were to give crizotinib first, we know from data that the median progression-free survival for first-line treatment of ALK-positive lung cancer with crizotinib is about 11 months. So 11 months, and then we know that the data shows that after crizotinib, if you give ceritinib, median progression-free survival is on the order of 7 months. So you put those together, that gives you a median progression-free survival of crizotinib plus ceritinib of about 18 months. In the trials that have looked at first-line ceritinib, the median progression-free survival is about 11 months. So it doesn't seem to buy you a lot to go from one drug to the other. I think the way it could make more sense to give crizotinib first is really a question of drug tolerability. While you can tweak the dose and kind of work things out with ceritinib, it takes some time. And in general, people, I think, find taking crizotinib to be a little bit easier agent than ceritinib. There are some exceptions to that. And for some patients with crizotinib, they have significant edema, bilateral lower extremity edema, hand edema, that can be a real problem. And for those patients, maybe it's not the answer to give crizotinib as the first line agent. Maybe an early switch to ceritinib for those patients who don't tolerate crizotinib well is a reasonable consideration.
Anything one in terms of research to try to, you know, bump these patients out farther or indefinitely? And I guess the one thing it seems obvious, and I see you're involved with some research looking at this, is somehow integrating checkpoint inhibitors or immune therapy in these patients. For example, this man here, he's doing great, but as you just said, he's kind of sitting on a not great situation most likely. Do we want to try to launch him into some kind of prolonged remission? Is that a strategy that's being thought about?
So I think that's certainly a great idea, and that's definitely the way we want to move forward. I think there's an empiric approach that's happening, you know, where people are beginning to combine these drugs. So ALK inhibitors being combined with PD-L1 and PD-1 inhibitors. Similarly, the same ideas are happening in EGFR mutant cancer, KRAS mutant cancer, a variety of diseases. The thing that we always have to keep in mind, though, is that what happened in melanoma when they combined vemurafenib plus ipilimumab, there was surprising, unexpected toxicity, particularly hepatotoxicity, when these agents were combined. And so we have to do this carefully. We can't just start doing this now that nivolumab is available and give off-label nivolumab plus something. I think we really have to explore this in trials.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. Another issue I'm curious about, and this relates to all kinds of targeted therapy, not just in lung cancer, is the concept of keeping an agent going beyond progression. And I see you were involved in a paper looking at that in terms of ALK, looking at treatment with crizotinib beyond progression, although I don't know, you know, if that's still as relevant now that you have ceritinib. But I mean, in the long run, even on ceritinib, the patient's going to progress. What do we know right now about this concept in ALK disease first?
So I think that's a critical thing. And I think you point out one of our challenges, which is that no matter which drug we pick, right now we have finite duration of progression-free survival for every single patient. Everybody's going to progress at some point. Maybe it's years down the road, maybe it's months down the road, but patients are going to progress. And you want to extract everything you can from the drug that you have a patient on at a given point. So for ALK-positive disease, I think that, you know, taking crizotinib and getting the best response out of it, and then if you have single sites of progression that are amenable to things like radiation or surgery or interventional radiology procedures like cryoablation or radiofrequency ablation, you should deploy those as best you can so that you can extract as much as you can from the crizotinib so that you don't have to make a switch in systemic therapy. So you can delay the start of the next progression-free survival clock, if you will.
So what would you be thinking about in this man if he were, and it seems pretty likely, to develop progression? Of course, it depends where. Is it in the brain? But let's just say he has progression and you feel that he needs some kind of systemic therapy. I'm sure it also makes a difference whether he's symptomatic, where it is. But globally, what would you be thinking about for his next treatment?
Right. This is an interesting thing. We'll be talking about a patient now who's almost 2 years into a course of treatment for non-small cell lung cancer. And what I'll be talking about with that patient is treatment with cisplatin and pemetrexed, maybe with bevacizumab, depending on the situation. So we're talking about a platinum-based therapy 2 years into the course of a patient's disease, which is, of course, much different than we thought about a few years back. But I think it's the right approach. And there's always this hint of extended benefit associated with pemetrexed treatment. And so I think that that's a very important drug to consider in the course of a patient with ALK-positive lung cancer. And I think cisplatin pemetrexed would be a very reasonable treatment for him.
I'm also thinking ahead, you know, if one of the anti-PD-1 agents is approved in adenocarcinoma, which seems like that would be quite feasible, what are they going to require in terms of pretreatment, for example, in a patient with a targetable mutation? Are they going to require chemo, or like a patient like this, can you go from targeted therapy directly to immunotherapy? Any thoughts?
Well, I think most of the trials right now are designed around patients who've had prior platinum-based chemotherapy. And so that's the way the label is certainly going to read. I think, is there some rational reason that patients need to have had platinum? Of course not. You know, I think it's just the standard of care for those patients who are ALK and EGFR negative. But I do think deploying immunotherapy in this situation is a perfectly reasonable strategy. I personally, in thinking about it today, I would favor a platinum-based chemotherapy as initial therapy for somebody like this, given the overall response rates that we've observed in patients who've been treated with single-agent PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors.
Although, you know, maybe I could say, suppose you had a situation, patient had a few new lung mets, completely asymptomatic, you know, thinking about sort of a renal or melanoma paradigm where, you know, you try to get the immunotherapy in, hoping for a long-term response, but who knows how that's going to play out.
No, absolutely. And I think that the appeal really is those patients who have long duration of response. And when we're sitting in front of our patients, that's what we want for them, is we want them to have a great disease control for a really long time.
Right. And what about the issue of other agents to treat ALK rearranged disease? I see you're involved with work with alectinib. What do we know about that as opposed to sorafenib, as opposed to crizotinib, and what other agents are out there being looked at?
Yeah, so there's really quite a number of drugs directed at patients with ALK-positive lung cancer that are in development. I think the one that's next in line behind sorafenib is alectinib. Alectinib began its initial development in Japan, and the first reported trial of alectinib in ALK-positive patients was treating patients who had not had prior crizotinib. And the response rate in that trial was over 90%, really demonstrating, you know, one of the highest response rates I've ever seen, honestly, in treatment of non-small cell lung cancer. And it was a really impressive phenomenon. And interestingly, the dose at that time was 300 milligrams. And when the alectinib was brought to the United States, we actually did a phase one trial to find out what the maximum tolerated dose is. The dose used in Japan was actually not the maximum tolerated dose. It was the dose based upon a variety of components of the drug that limited what could be dosed in Japan. And so when it came to the United States, we did an initial phase one trial in a multi-center collaboration and identified that the maximum tolerated dose was much higher. And in fact, the recommended phase two dose is really double that dose that was achieved in Japan.
So were the GI issues and hepatic issues seen with alectinib?
It seems to be a little bit better tolerated drug. You know, it's still very early for both drugs in terms of the number of patients treated, but my personal experience with both drugs is that it's relatively better tolerated.
How would you compare to a novice like myself, sort of the pharmacology of alectinib and sorafenib and crizotinib? Is alectinib like sorafenib?
Yeah, alectinib is very much like sorafenib in the sense that it's a better ALK inhibitor. There is some preclinical evidence that they have slightly different profiles of inhibition so that, you know, for some ALK mutant forms of cancer, there might be somewhat greater benefit for alectinib versus sorafenib. But right now, that data is not strong enough that you would, you know, pick a drug based upon a mutation profile. And so in that way, alectinib and sorafenib are very similar. They're better ALK inhibitors.
If you sort of look out over the next year or two, and you mentioned there are a whole bunch of other agents, what agents, it sounds like alectinib has some pretty strong data. Do you think it's going to be available? Are there other agents you think might become available in the next couple of years?
I think alectinib is certainly the next in line to become available. I would hope it's available in the next year. And I don't know anything about the development strategy in terms of approval for that, but I do hope that that one's got an option for the next year. And then, of course, the next big thing in lung cancer really is going to be the potential approval of two classes. One is the potential approval of nivolumab in or other PD-1 inhibitors for non-squamous patients. So right now, nivolumab is FDA approved for squamous cell lung cancer. There's a randomized trial that's completed and data analysis is going on right now for treatment of non-squamous patients with nivolumab. Similarly, pembrolizumab has been explored in the first line setting. Their difference there is that they've looked at patients who are PD-L1 positive, so they have a biomarker. Nivolumab has not used a biomarker to date, but pembrolizumab is requiring a biomarker.
You mentioned the issue if this patient progressed and of using chemotherapy, cis-pem. What do you see in terms of response to chemo and ALK-positive disease? Do you think there's a better response with, you know, PEM, which I've kind of heard? What do you see in your practice?
I think that these drugs are effective for all patients with lung cancer, and they might be slightly more effective for those patients with ALK-positive disease. We do have data from the randomized trial of cis-PEM versus crizotinib in first-line treatment of ALK-positive lung cancer. The efficacy of the cisplatin-pemetrexed combination was not overwhelming, but it was definitely a solid combination. And so that's my preferential treatment. The data that suggests pemetrexed is better than docetaxel, of course, comes from the second line trial where patients were randomized to standard of care chemotherapy or crizotinib. In the standard of care chemotherapy, a significant proportion of patients got docetaxel and the remainder of the patients got pemetrexed. When you compare the outcomes of those patients, particularly by progression-free survival, you see that the progression-free survival was much better for pemetrexed than it was for docetaxel.
And also the issue of bevacizumab that you mentioned. In general, how are you approaching today the use of bevacizumab with chemotherapy? And is it any different in patients with targetable mutations, not just ALK, but also EGFR?
You know, I don't have a foundation for choosing whether or not to use Bev based on their mutation status, with one exception. And that's the data that you saw at ASCO last year and was presented earlier this year that demonstrated that combining bevacizumab with erlotinib in the first-line setting significantly improves progression-free survival. Now, it's a Japanese study. It's relatively small, but it sure looks like the addition of bevacizumab makes a difference. And if, you know, you think about it, if we believe that adding bevacizumab to chemo helps, why wouldn't it help when you add it to erlotinib?
So for practical purposes, what are you doing when you start, for example, an EGF TKI? Do you think about using Bev? Do you think about it if they progress? What are you doing?
So I met a 64-year-old lady yesterday who had EGFR mutant lung cancer diagnosed. She had pleural effusion, lung mass, and had drainage of her pleural effusion. And we sat down to talk about the options. I gave her three options. One was a clinical trial that combined erlotinib plus MPDL-3280A, the anti-PDL-1 drug. Another option was erlotinib plus bevacizumab. And the final option was standard of care single agent erlotinib. You know, it's a really big challenge when you meet these patients. They're new to this whole oncology business, right? They've got a lot of different priorities in place. This particular patient was very clear about her priorities, which is to spend as little time in doctor's offices as possible. And so as a consequence, she walked out of the office with a prescription for erlotinib, and that was the plan. Other patients are going more for the best response possible or the longest duration of response, and those patients are happy to take erlotinib plus bevacizumab or investigate clinical trial options.
We do have, obviously, as you mentioned, next generation, you know, TKIs and EGFR disease, but I have heard people talking about, you know, adding in bevacizumab to a patient, you know, who responds to erlotinib and then has, you know, say, gradual progression. Is that something you ever do?
I actually haven't done that. I've heard those anecdotes as well, and it's definitely intriguing. And I think that without the options that we have in terms of next-generation EGFR inhibitors and other clinical trials, it's something I would certainly consider.
So just to finish out on ALK, I was curious whether or not patients have been treated with alectinib who progressed on ceritinib or vice versa, and are they, you know, cross-resistant?
So there's very limited data on that for a variety of reasons, much of which is related to clinical trial inclusion and exclusion criteria. But I would say that in my limited experience that sometimes they work. you know, in one situation or the other. It's not the 60-70% response rate that we see after crizotinib for either alectinib or ceritinib, but there is definitely a response rate. It's probably better than what we see with standard chemotherapies like docetaxel or single agent pemetrexed. And as a consequence, that is the strategy I prefer. If I don't have a trial available for a patient coming off of alectinib or ceritinib, I will try one of those agents.
So let's talk about your 70-year-old man.
This is a 70-year-old guy who's, when I initially met him, he was a business consultant and still, you know, even at the age of 70, was traveling the Monday through Thursday business consultant schedule and feeling relatively well, but he was identified to have lung cancer based on bilateral lung masses. When I saw him, I treated him with cisplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab. We had done our routine panel at that time, which looked for EGFR, looked for ALK, looked for KRAS. He was negative for all those things. This guy was a never smoker. I was, you know, certainly hoping that I could find something else. But at the time, I had nothing. And so I started him on cisplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab, and he then got maintenance pemetrexed and bevacizumab. Then the story about ROS1 really became much more prominent, and our laboratory developed testing for ROS1, and we had also begun testing for RET rearrangements as well. We had a kind of a panel of things that we looked for in those never smokers who were negative. And so I sent his tissue for testing for ROS1 and RET, and lo and behold, his ROS1 result came back positive. And I was really thrilled to see that, and I talked about it with the patient. I told him, you know, we have a very clear option for treatment for you, and, you know, it's our question about when we decide to deploy this. The patient was on pemetrexed bevacizumab maintenance at that point, and he had a great response to therapy. He was doing well. He was tolerating the treatment well. He was back at work. And so he and I made the decision that we would choose to use the crizotinib whenever we saw the hint of growth on CT scans. But now we're almost 2 years later, and the patient hasn't had growth. He's had continued stable disease on pemetrexed bevacizumab maintenance, and the crizotinib remains a lovely option that we have available to us.
That's really a very instructive case. Your initial choice of therapy with cis, PEM, and BEV, and then PEM, BEV maintenance, can you talk a little bit more about why you choose that? You've got the cis versus carbo, PEM versus paclitaxel, and whether to use BEV. Why did you choose this in this man?
Right. I'm generally impressed by the efficacy of cisplatin-based regimens, and our chemo suite and our team is very used to giving cisplatin. Patients, I think, have relatively good tolerability of cisplatin. I think if you compare cisplatin to carboplatin, there are definitely different side effect profiles. And for instance, carboplatin has significantly more myelosuppression than cisplatin does. And as a consequence, I'm very comfortable giving cisplatin, and I do it for most of my patients who are 70 or younger. And so he was able to fit into that category. Pemetrexed, I think, is most people's standard first-line therapy for non-squamous. And then I feel like the addition of bevacizumab to cisplatin and pemetrexed is a very reasonable choice, given the data we have showing that, in general, bevacizumab adds to the efficacy of platinum-based regimens. Clearly, there's no trial that compares cisplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab to cisplatin pemetrexed, but I think it's reasonable to say that it's probably going to improve outcomes. And the side effect profile is very modest, and the rate of significant toxicity for bevacizumab is low.
So maybe you can provide an update on where we are with ROS rearranged non-small cell lung cancer. You were part of a big paper last November in the New England Journal about crizotinib. What do we know about treatment effects?
It's a relatively uncommon entity, this ROS1 positive cancer. It happens in just about 1% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. But we do have two trials that have now published. One is the trial you alluded to in the New England Journal of Medicine with a relatively small number of patients. I believe it was 50 patients. We showed a significant response rate, kind of what you expect for patients with oncogene-driven cancers and tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but of surprisingly long median progression-free survival. The median progression-free survival was over a year and a half, which is probably the longest progression-free survival that's been reported for a tyrosine kinase inhibitor in lung cancer. More recently, the Europeans published a retrospective analysis of patients with ROS1 positive cancer treated with crizotinib. This was published, I believe, in the JCO, and they showed similar high response rates. Their progression-free survival was not quite as good, but it was a smaller series. But taken together, there's really significant evidence to support the use of crizotinib in ROS1 positive disease. I think we'll have to see where things go in terms of an FDA approval, but this is certainly listed in the NCCN guidelines as a rational approach, and I think it's easy to make a good case for it.
So I want to let you present one final case. I think it's really an amazing case. You're a 73-year-old man with a BRAF mutant disease. But before I do, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about other things that are going on in lung cancer. And one thing in particular, you mentioned the issue of FDA approvals. You know, we did see the approval of another agent in lung cancer, this time an anti-angiogenic, ramucirumab. We've been talking about this agent, you know, an antibody to the VEGF2 receptor for a couple of years at least now in gastric cancer where it's approved. But now it's been approved in lung cancer. Can you talk about the data behind this and what your take is clinically, and do you ever use this strategy?
So ramucirumab is an anti-VEGFR2 antibody. As you said, we've been talking about it in a variety of clinical settings for years. But more importantly, we've been talking about bevacizumab, another anti-vascular endothelial growth factor antibody. And so the strategy of anti-angiogenesis is obviously good, but the field is also reminded of numerous randomized trials in the second line setting where docetaxel was combined with, you know, any number of agents, but many anti-angiogenesis agents, and they've all been failed trials that have failed to improve overall survival, failed to improve progression-free survival, and in general, a disappointment. But I think that there is a significant amount of data now showing that ramucirumab does improve progression-free survival, does improve overall survival, and improves response rate in that second-line setting in combination with docetaxel. So the data is not dramatic. We don't see marked increase in progression-free overall survival, but there definitely is an improvement, and the adverse effects associated with ramucirumab treatment are modest. So I think it's definitely something to consider in your patient who does not have EGFR, does not have ALK, and is in front of you, who you're deciding on whether you want to give second-line docetaxel. And if you're thinking about second-line docetaxel, I don't think there's a reason not to give ramucirumab in addition.
Does that mean you do it?
I do it from time to time.
I guess the one issue that people bring up, it is, as you say, kind of a marginal clinical benefit, but it is there. I guess the main downside would be the cost.
Yeah, it's certainly a cost factor, you know, and I guess that's a huge issue that we in oncology are beginning to confront, the significance of cost. And I think for most of us, and I think for many of our patients, cost remains relatively less visible in terms of their day-to-day experience. Most of our patients have already hit some sort of cap on the out-of-pocket expenses in a given year. And so that's not such an important thing for them. But at the same time, it is an important thing for the system in general. And I think we do have to consider this as we think about how guidelines develop treatment recommendations.
Well, also the issue of what you do in practice. I mean, your colleague down the hall, Len Saltz in GI cancer, just wrote a editorial that got into this in terms of bevacizumab and colon cancer. And I'm just curious, looking at this decision to ramucirumab, the way we've kind of dissected it out, you know, again, assuming, as you say, that you're looking at a patient where out-of-pocket's not a big issue, do you think that you as an individual physician should be thinking about sort of society or the individual in front of you, or how do you combine it?
Yeah, that's the challenge, is how you combine it, because, you know, I don't think in the room we can think about society. We have to think about the patient in front of us. You know, as a professional and as a member of the NCCN guideline panel, I do have to think about society, and I have to think about how we make recommendations as a consequence of that. But in the room, you want to think of everything you can to help that person sitting there live longer and have better control of their disease. If it's only a marginal benefit, as we suggest it is for ramucirumab, then it's certainly something that we even start to think about, what are the costs that are non-financial associated with it? You know, is this going to mean I'm sitting in the chair longer? Does this mean I'm having to come more frequently? Does this mean I have other side effects that I'm going to have to deal with? These are important things to talk about with the patient.
Absolutely. Let's talk about your 73-year-old man, this man with the BRAF mutant disease. This is really amazing.
So this is a guy who, you know, I actually inherited him from another doctor who left the institution. He had been initially diagnosed with early stage disease. And then about 2 years after his treatment for early stage disease, which was just surgery alone. He did not meet criteria for adjuvant chemotherapy, had stage 1B disease. 2 years after that, he developed recurrence in the pleura with a significant pleural effusion. I sent him to one of our thoracic surgeons who did a video-assisted thoracoscopy, put in a pleurex catheter, and drained the pleural effusion. Now, over time, the pleural effusion dried up, and there was no evidence of cancer on the scan. So actually, the pleurex was removed, and I was following him by symptom and with CT scans every 2 to 3 months. And then over time, he developed shortness of breath. So this was actually between one of those interval CT scans. He came to see me and said, you know, doc, I used to be able to walk, I used to be able to play handball, and now I can't play handball. My breathing is much more short. I don't know how I'm going to deal with this. So we did a scan. It was not recurrence of the pleural effusion as I expected. It was instead a significant lymphangitic spread of his cancer. And so, you know, this hazy infiltrate that you see in the lungs, the patient was reluctant to think that this could possibly be cancer. I said, we can try a short course of steroids and antibiotics to make sure that this isn't something else. So I gave him a week's worth of steroids and antibiotics. It was clearly lymphangitic spread of his cancer. Things were getting worse. So I had known from his molecular analysis of his prior tumor that he was BRAF mutant. So I said, let's look into treating this with a BRAF inhibitor. I know the response rate for dabrafenib in lung cancer with BRAF mutations is about 30%. I think, you know, this would be a rational strategy for you.
Could I just clarify, though, what kind of BRAF mutation he had? Because I've heard there's some that are activating, some that aren't. What did he have?
He had the BRAF V600E, which is right. The activating one that we see in melanoma and is the one that we have the data for in dabrafenib-treated BRAF mutant non-small cell lung cancer. So he did have that activating mutation. So as you know, when you think about giving some of these drugs, there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through if you decide to try to treat with dabrafenib in BRAF mutant lung cancer. You write a prescription, you start to navigate the insurance approval process. And my team is great. They do this all the time. And they started the process, but the patient was getting worse while we waited for things. And so I talked to the patient. I said, you know, we've got a tough choice here, but I think we need to do something. Otherwise, your breathing is going to get so bad. He's on oxygen at this point. It's really tough. And so I gave him treatment with pemetrexed carboplatin, because he had some renal insufficiency and he was a little on the older side. I gave him pemetrexed and carboplatin. I think he had a little bit of hemoptysis, which is why I didn't give him bevacizumab, but we gave him carboplatin pemetrexed, and he had a dramatic response. This is a guy who, again, he's on oxygen, very short of breath from his cancer. We gave him pemetrexed carboplatin. By the time he came back for cycle 2, he was off oxygen. He was back to playing handball. And, you know, I was totally blown away by that. He got 6 cycles of carboplatin pemetrexed, and he continues on pemetrexed as maintenance therapy. And he's actually a year into treatment now and doing very well.
Really an amazing story. How did he tolerate therapy?
He did very well with it. He has had essentially a couple days of fatigue with each cycle, no significant lab abnormalities, no nausea or vomiting. He's done well.
What would you do if you had disease progression?
At this point, I would look for a trial, and right now we actually have a trial of vemurafenib in BRAF mutant cancer. There's an ongoing trial internationally giving dabrafenib and trametinib, so combining BRAF inhibitor and MEK inhibitor as we've seen done in melanoma, and that data looks certainly promising.
One other issue related to EGFR-based treatment is EGFR antibodies, and we know the FDA is currently evaluating the agent necitumumab.
So the big difference between cetuximab and necitumumab is necitumumab actually has data in a first-line randomized trial showing that it adds significantly to overall survival for patients with squamous cell lung cancer treated with gemcitabine cisplatin. So that's the big advantage for necitumumab. There's not a lot of other difference in terms of its efficacy or pharmacology, but I think it's very reasonable to explore its role in combination with EGFR TKIs. We don't have enough data yet for that or for panitumumab or any of the other EGFR antibodies, but it's definitely something that we need to look at.
Is necitumumab an agent, you know, sort of getting back to the ramucirumab kind of question, you know, with, you know, borderline benefits, is it something that if it were approved, you would use it?
I think it's a little harder to make that leap, and I'll tell you why. Rash. You know, so when you add necitumumab to chemotherapy, it improves modestly progression-free and overall survival, but you're adding a significant toxicity to the patient that they would otherwise be without. And in the setting of modest clinical efficacy, I think it's a tough sell.
How much of a difference, you know, you have Mario Lacutera there, the you know, king of dermatologic oncology side effects. You know, he has all these strategies he uses. He does the randomized trials, et cetera. You know, what kind of an impact is that having on your patients, not just with EGFR antibodies, but in general?
Well, I have to say, having Mario Lacouture at our institution is a tremendous asset. You know, he not only knows the EGFR rash world better than anybody, he understands rashes associated with all these drugs that we use. And, you know, vemurafenib has a maculopapular rash associated with it. He's been wonderful at characterizing that and really showing that you can treat through that and modify courses of patients, you know, whereas we would oftentimes get rid of drugs, stop using them because we found that dermatologic toxicities were too much. If we have adequate ways to manage these things, we can get a lot more for our patients and they can tolerate the treatments a lot better.
Any particular strategy that you've seen that, you know, surprised you or maybe people aren't aware of that are as effective?
You know, I think the EGFR-related drugs have been out there a long time, and I think that just the use of topical corticosteroids is probably the main thing that we've done that I think is a little bit newer than, say, the old days. We used a lot of moisturizers and a lot of antibiotics, but the role of topical steroids, I think, is significant.
How important, again, let's say EGFR rashes, is sunscreen and avoidance of sun? Does that make a big difference or not really?
Oh, it's critically important for EGFR drugs. The sun can really do wonders on our patients. You know, I think do wonders in bad ways. You know, as my practice in New York, you know, a lot of patients head down to Florida for intermittent parts of the winter, and they go from no sun to all of a sudden being out in the sun a lot. And plenty of patients come back with very severe exacerbation of skin toxicities as a consequence of sun. And so the more sunscreen and, you know, beyond that, you know, covering up is really critical.